Hello, and welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Dan Pacella, co-founder, lead investigator for Orange County, New York, Paranormal. If you are back to us, a return listener, thank you so much for coming back. We really appreciate it. If you're new to the festivities, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on whatever podcast platform that you're listening on. And also, the video version of this is available on our YouTube channel and our Facebook page. So if you're watching us that way, make sure to subscribe and to ring the bell on YouTube, because we have a lot of videos coming out, a lot of investigation videos along with the podcast and a lot of other content there. But thank you for the support so far. It's nice to see that every episode of this podcast continues to get more and more listeners. So thank you all for that. And, you know, keep sharing, keep liking, keep reviewing, and tell your friends, because it's nice to see the podcast grow, and it's nice to have these relatable paranormal conversations with more and more people. So, what is the topic of today's episode? Well, we're going to talk today about some of our favorite mistakes that we've made and what we've learned from them and how we've adjusted to them and what exactly we did wrong and what it led to down the road. We're also going to do a deep dive into a recent investigation video that came out about the Gilboa Museum. There's a lot to talk about with that. If you haven't seen the video, I'll put a link in the description. It's also available on our YouTube channel and Facebook page, but I want to talk about some of the interesting things that happened in that really interesting location. But first, we want to talk about mistakes. And, you know, mistakes are interesting because, first of all, nobody's perfect. I mean, we aren't perfect. Nobody's perfect. And one of the things that I always say, because I do a lot of public speaking in my professional life, is, you know, we're imperfect beings talking to imperfect beings. And there are a lot of mistakes that we make, and some are just regrets and some are mistakes. There's a difference, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go through it. But the ones we're going to talk about today, the specific instances, these are the ones that keep us up at night. They keep me up at night, and man, you wish you could correct it. And, you know, in life, we've all done this. We all have things that, you know, we lay awake in bed at night thinking about. For us, though, it's more about missed opportunities. It's about flat-out errors that hindered an investigation, something that we missed that ended up causing physical harm. And, you know, most of these, when I was going through and trying to pick the, you know, the three of these I really wanted to highlight, it all happened kind of early in our adventures, or in terms of Emily and I going solo. Because, you know, as I've said in previous episodes, we started out doing the group thing. We started out buying tickets to events, and we just sort of set out on our own. But, you know, mistakes were bound to happen, and it seems like a lot of these are from the early years, but again, the reason why they're mostly from the early years is we learned from them, and we grew from them. So that begs the question, why call them our favorite mistakes? And they're my favorite mistakes because I actually do cherish them. I do cherish them. They're not, one of them specifically is not a fond memory. But the rest of it is, yeah, it's annoying. Yeah, it's agitating. But at the same time, it keeps me from just sort of being, you know, laissez-faire when something's happening in an investigation. It taught us that you can't just assume that everything's going to work. You can't just assume that words that come through a piece of equipment or a foreboding feeling or a foreboding warning don't mean something. You can't just, you know, you have to learn to put two and two together. And when you start out, you're not as good at it. And it's because of these mistakes that we've gotten very good at connecting the dots and understanding what things mean and understanding how this whole thing works to prevent us from having even more mistakes that we'll cherish. Because as much as these are our favorite mistakes, I don't really like making mistakes. Most people don't. I'm very OCD. If you don't believe me, go back and listen to the episode about how we prepare for an investigation. So mistakes bother us, but they also teach us to be better at this. And we're better for all of these mistakes, even though one in particular was pretty nasty and caused some physical harm. So the first one that I want to dive into is really just a missed opportunity that still bothers us. When we investigated the Worcester Inn back in September of 2019, something occurred during that investigation that never happens. As I've stated in previous episodes about paranormal television, when we investigate like a hotel, the hotel doesn't close down. We can't pay the hotel to close down. So we generally have a selection of rooms that aren't booked, and they just happen to not be booked. Our first investigation at the Worcester Inn, the four rooms that are actively haunted weren't booked. The second time we went in September, none of the rooms were booked. We had the entire hotel to ourselves and did not take adequate advantage of it. Every room was empty. Every hallway was empty. We could have done so many things, so many experiments. Now, we did not know this was the case until we got there. And right before we started, the owner, Jim, said, "Oh, by the way, you're the only people in the hotel tonight." If we had had some time to really wrap our brains around that, we would have probably come up with more. But there's a couple of reasons why we made this mistake. And I think it all really boils down to we thought we'd have another chance. The Worcester Inn was not really that busy in the time of year that we were there. It got filled up, but there were plenty of nights when no one was there, especially during the week and, you know, sort of off-season for upstate New York. So we had a standing invitation to investigate there whenever we wanted. We thought there'd be other nights. It turned out that was the last night. And we never thought that would be the last time that we would ever investigate there. As I said, this was September 2019, and in February of 2020, we did an event there with some friends of ours, and it was really well attended, and everybody was very happy about it, and it was a lot of fun. Not an investigation, it's an event. They're very different things, as I've talked about in the past. We all know what happened in March of 2020. With COVID-19 and the whole shutdown. And actually, we were supposed to investigate there again in April, and we had to cancel it because of the COVID-19 shutdown. And then in December, the owner of the Worcester Inn, Jim Bulow, passed away. And Jim was an amazing guy, and we would not be doing any of this, regardless of where we are or what we're doing. None of it would be without Jim. Jim was the first owner of any location that took us seriously. He was the first owner of any location that believed in what we were trying to do. And we had had a couple of disastrous first investigations. And if it weren't for Jim really buying in and understanding what it was that we were trying to accomplish and giving us access that no one else ever gave us, we would not be here now. So rest in peace, Jim. He was a dear friend. But after he passed away, the Worcester Inn closed. And we have not been back. There's talk of it reopening, but we really haven't been in contact with anyone. I don't know what it's going to reopen as. But we did not know at the time that was going to be the last night. And it teaches you just can't take that stuff for granted. And now we look back at that and are like, what on earth were we thinking? We had the whole place to ourselves and did not do anything with it. It bothers me to this day, as you can probably tell from the sound of my voice. And nowadays, we think about it, man, we'd never let that happen now. Never let that opportunity pass us by now. But back then, you know, we didn't prepare for it. We didn't have nearly as much equipment. I couldn't have put cameras in that whole place. I don't even know if I could have done cameras in that whole place now when we got, you know, 16 of them. It was a big place, but we should have done more than we did. It was a mistake that we made, but it taught us never, ever assume you're going to go back somewhere and never, ever let an opportunity where you get free reign over a building, never let that pass you by. The second mistake I want to highlight is not necessarily a specific mistake. It's more of a theme of a mistake, although I do have a specific example. And it's just not using equipment properly or not checking things or not understanding how a new piece of equipment works. When it comes to the cameras, it's not a mistake to aim the camera the wrong way. It isn't. You don't know where paranormal activity is going to happen. Oh, I have so many regrets. Oh, I wish I'd put a camera here. I wish I'd put a camera there. The best example of that is at Hillview Manor. We had a camera not 3 feet away from where a book slid off a shelf onto the floor. The problem was it was on a corner, so the camera couldn't pick it up. It picked up the sound really well, that you can hear it sliding. And you know what? Do I wish I had put the camera to where it could have picked that up? Yes. Do I wish I had a photo or any kind of film showing that book on the shelf before it fell? Oh my goodness, yes. But that's not a mistake. That's just, hey, this hallway's hot, put a camera here. So we did. So I don't count that as a mistake. What I do count as a mistake is getting a new piece of equipment and maybe not understanding fully how it works, not continually checking on the cameras or any of the equipment we're doing. The worst thing, the worst feeling in the world is when I go back to review evidence. Remember, we're a very technology-based paranormal group. All we have are the cameras and recorders. That's it. That's the only kind of evidence we're looking to get. When I take out that memory card and I put it into the computer and something went wrong and the camera did not work or did not function or functioned weirdly or functioned incorrectly, it's aggravating, so aggravating. I'm getting aggravated now just thinking about it. Probably the most aggravating example is from a farmhouse we investigated in Sharon Springs, New York. This was a residential investigation, one of the very few residential investigations that we actually published a video on. Residential investigations are private, but no one was living in the home. We have not ever disclosed the exact location of the home, even though a few folks have made some pretty good guesses, who apparently had lived there before. But that's not the point. This house, it also ended up being one of the few residential investigations we've done where the place was actually haunted. We picked up a ton of evidence in that house. And one of my favorite investigations we've ever done. And while we were there, on the second floor, a door that was right in front of me, it closed when no one was near it. And I heard it do it because it was, you know, dark, so I couldn't see it, but I had heard. There wasn't a lot of ambient light. This thing was out in the country. And I also remember it was about minus 10 degrees that night, so it was very cold. But the door closed. I heard it close. We put our flashlight on it. It had closed. And I'm like, whoa, that's amazing, because I have a stationary camera 15 feet behind me that caught it. It caught it. At least I thought it caught it. When I went back to review the evidence, this camera, which I had just recently purchased, it didn't stay on. It recorded for the first 40 minutes. The external power source I used apparently wasn't compatible with it, and it turned off and only recorded the first 45 minutes, and this event happened toward the end of the investigation. So, didn't capture it on camera, therefore, didn't happen. And I'll never know whether that was paranormal or not. It may not have been. It may have been that we bumped it coming in, we knocked something that was holding it open, we tripped over a wire. It could have been one of a thousand things. But the thing that bothers us the most is we'll never know if that was paranormal or not, because we never got a chance to look at it. We never got a chance to study it. We never got a chance to debunk it. And so that's the most aggravating part of that. That's a mistake. It's not that we aimed the camera exactly in the right place. The mistake was not knowing the camera well enough, because it was a new kind of camera, and B, just not checking it. Not checking. And that is 100% on me. I am the tech. I am supposed to be on all of this. And I wasn't, and I didn't, and we missed out on what could have been an amazing piece of evidence, or just something we ended up debunking. But we'll never know. And that's the frustrating thing, that we will never, ever know if that was paranormal. And it's my fault that we'll never know, because the camera malfunctioned. Now, what do? Oh, I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with checking the cameras. In fact, I've actually rigged all of our stationary cameras up with the kind of external batteries that have indicators on them, so I can see when they're functioning. I can see when they're working. I check them every time I walk past them now, because I just live in fear that that's going to happen again, that something amazing is going to happen, and because I didn't do something right, we don't get it. And that's drives me crazy. To this day, I'm still mad about it, and it was about 3 years ago. So this last one's a little more serious, because it ended up with some physical harm, and it was more of a series of mistakes leading to something bad that happened that we should have seen coming. And this was from the Burlington County prison in Burlington, New Jersey. This is one of the first times, like I guess the second time we were actually like out doing this, filming, you know, trying to, you know, document evidence instead of just experiencing the paranormal. And it's a jail. And so, you know, prisons are different. Prisons are not always the most friendly people in the world. We catch very interesting words in prisons that we don't get anywhere else. And I'll bet you can guess what some of those words are. I can't say them on a podcast, but I bet you can guess what they are. And we should have seen what ended up happening coming. Maybe not the actual event itself, but that something was going to happen. So we were there, and it had gone just fine, and we got some really good evidence there. And it was about, we had to be out of there about midnight. And at 11 o'clock, I'm walking through like the lobby. It's a museum now. So I'm walking through the lobby with my camera and a loud bang on the front door. And I'm like, okay, that I would love for that to be a spirit, but I don't think it is. And then the door swings open and a policeman aims a taser at me. And I'm really lucky he didn't tase me because I was holding one of our handheld cameras. And in the dark, that kind of looks a little bit like a gun or a taser or a something. So I'm very fortunate that, you know, he did a really good job of not tasering first, asking questions later. However, in the end, I wish he had gotten me because then what happened to Emily wouldn't have happened. But it was a misunderstanding. Somebody had seen flashlight lights from the town because that museum's in the center of town. And they called the police thinking they were trespassers. The whoever was supposed to call the police and say we had people there late that night didn't do it. So the cops came and it was fine. Both of the police officers were fantastic, and we talked and we, you know, joked around with them for a few minutes before they left, and they left. Didn't think much of it at the time. But Emily and I were the two people, because there were some other few folks there too, but Emily and I were the ones who spoke to the police officer and were talking to him and, you know, and being jovial with them and everything. Didn't think much of it. I mean, looking back now, it should have been obvious. Okay, we're yucking it up with a cop in a prison. That might make somebody a little angry. Didn't think about it then. So we're upstairs on the second floor. I believe that's the top floor, and of this prison. And we're walking around, and it's, you know, very 19th century prison-like. And we're just doing some work in a cell, trying to get some audio, asking questions, you know, all the usual stuff, just trying to kind of put a lid on the evening. And the ovulus gives us a couple of words. For those of you who aren't aware, an ovulus is a phonetic generator. And the concept of the ovulus is that it throws out a list of words into the electromagnetic spectrum and allows spirits to select those words to communicate. That's the theory behind it. The ovulus device, it's proved itself to me for the just some of the really just bang on the money stuff that it has said. I've had more instances with the ovulus where it will say something, like it'll say a word, and then I'll have a camera nearby that'll pick up an EVP, a voice of the same word. So that piece of equipment has proven its legitimacy to us simply because we've got so much evidence of it being right, being relevant, and also other. I love when one piece of equipment backs up the evidence captured by another. That's the best. And it's happened with the ovulus at least half a dozen times. So we're sitting in the cell with the ovulus, and it says, angry and living. Those are the two words that pop up. It was our first time using an ovulus device. And again, we didn't think much of it. And I don't know why. I mean, it's the inexperience. That's really what it was. It's not putting two and two together. It's being excited at the prospect of getting something, but not actually thinking about what you're getting, what you're saying, where you're standing or sitting when it said it, and what that could possibly lead to down the road. So, angry and living. 10 minutes later, we're walking down the cement stairs. I'm in front, Emily is behind me. And she is pushed very hard by an unseen force. Pushed so hard, mind you, that when she hit me, she didn't slow down. She actually accelerated through me. Physics doesn't work that way. And I'm a big dude, and I should slow down anything that runs into me. She went through me like I wasn't even there. And to give you an idea of how hard that push was, I had to peel the gray paint of the railing off of her front teeth. That's how hard she hit that. And she had two black eyes for almost a month after that. I always give her credit. That was our second solo investigation. And she was like, no, I'm good. I'm good. Once I recover, we'll be good to go again. I know a lot of people who would have been like, nope, done. I am done. That is it. Emily, I think it just actually made her even more interested in what was going on. And, you know, she recovered just fine from that. We've done other prisons, so if there was any kind of lasting phobia from that, she's conquered that. But looking back, it was foolish of us to not see the signs, and it was a mistake that we didn't see the signs. A police officer comes at 11 o'clock. Emily and I talk to him jovially, talking to him very nicely. And so from the eyes of a spirit, we brought the police there because the police wouldn't have been called if we weren't there. Then, 30 minutes later, we get angry and living. So whatever's there is saying, I'm angry at the living. We're in a prison. We should have seen something coming. We should have seen what was going to happen. And honestly, I'm sure the energy in the building changed too. But again, we were so inexperienced at that point. Now we're much better at feeling the energy and feeling the shifts in tone and the shifts in mood and when it gets heavier and when it gets a little bit, you know, we're really good at that. Emily's way better at that than I am. But, you know, your body's a tool. In paranormal investigation, your body's the best tool. And the more you fine-tune it, the better the tool becomes. So I think if that had happened today, we'd be like, all right, hold up a second. Let's take stock as to what's happened here. And let's just be extra, extra careful to make sure that nothing bad happens. But we didn't. We didn't. And Emily paid the physical price for it. Two black eyes. Like I said, I had to peel the paint off her teeth. And she looked way worse than she felt. But that was jarring. A jarring experience. I ended up on the floor too. But I mean, because she knocked me over. But I didn't get it at all. Like she did. She bore the brunt of that. And what it taught us was that it's not enough just to have communication. It's not enough just to have a word come through the ovulus or something come through the spirit box or something come through the phasm box. You have to analyze everything that comes through because it may seem irrelevant at the time. It all seems irrelevant. Until you're laying on the floor of a prison covered in dust with two black eyes, having to have the gray paint of the railing of the stairs peeled off your teeth. It was a mistake that we both made ignoring the signs. It's a mistake we'll never make again. And in the long run, something like that was probably going to happen. And something like that probably happens to every investigator at some point. Maybe not that severe, but there's something that happens where you're like, why didn't I see that coming? Really? And that's ours. And I'm not glad it happened. We really wish it hadn't. But thankfully, nobody was hurt in the long term. Nobody was seriously hurt. Emily has done, you know, 60 investigations with me since then. And it was a mistake. But it's a mistake that taught us a very valuable lesson. And honestly, I'm glad we learned it early because we probably stopped more incidents like that from happening just by being aware of the fact that they can. So that's a look back at some of our favorite mistakes, if you will. And like I said earlier, they're our favorite because they taught us lessons that we carry with us to every investigation and everything we do. Now, and I hope if there's any aspiring investigators out there or new investigators out there, take heed of what those mistakes were so you can try to avoid them. Don't worry, you'll make plenty of your own mistakes. We make a mistake every investigation. There's no perfect investigation. There just isn't. But avoiding the big stuff, that's what you want to try and do. So what I want to talk about now is we had an investigation video come out on our YouTube channel and our Facebook page. I'll put a link in the description if you haven't seen it, on the Gilboa Museum. And it's been really well received. Thank you to everybody who's checked that out. And I wanted to talk about some of the stuff that we found, because that was a fascinating, fascinating investigation. And I want to spend a few minutes just kind of doing a deep dive on some of the stuff that we don't talk we don't go deep in the videos on each piece of evidence, but in a platform like this, it's nice to be able to expand. First of all, the one thing about that location that was really nice was how small it was. And it's not a small building, but compared to some of the places we go, it was kind of nice to not have to set up six cameras and, you know, split up and need a team of people. It was three rooms. You had two rooms upstairs and a basement. And it was nice. I can't remember the last time we were able to just sit in a room for that much time and just feel it and experience it. Because when you do an investigation of a large location, yeah, you try to do those things, but a lot of time you're on a limited time schedule. And you want to make sure you get everywhere. So I think there's the temptation to go a little quicker than you want to go sometimes. And it was nice to be freed of that. The evidence was really good. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure when we agreed to go there that we were going to get much of anything. I had never heard of it. And that's the best. Those are the best kind, by the way. The ones you've never heard of. Oh, my goodness. Those are my favorite places to investigate. You can have the famous ones. I will take 100 Gilboa Museum kind of locations. But when we were invited to go there, I'm like, all right, well, there's no evidence of it in the past. But the person, Linda, who invited us, came to one of our events and said, hey, I'd love to have you folks. I've had some paranormal groups, but I've never really seen any evidence because they kind of disappeared, which is all too common, unfortunately. And we said, sure, absolutely, because, you know, it's hard enough to get locations, as I talked about in the previous episode of the podcast. We'll take an invite. Oh, my goodness, yes. So we got there, and I'll tell you, is any skepticism I had over whether we were going to get any evidence there quickly died once I got in the building, because Emily and I both kind of looked at each other in the way that we look at each other when we know, when we have this feeling, and we're like, yeah, there's energy here. Now, what surprised me about the energy is that the energy kind of knew what to do. And what I mean by that is, usually when we investigate a place and it's not a place that's investigated a lot, the first time we don't always get a lot, because, you know, the dealing with the dead is a lot like dealing with the living, and we are complete strangers to these folks. And a lot of these spirits are supposedly school children, so they're going to be standoffish regardless, let alone to two complete strangers. I don't walk up to a complete stranger and start talking to them. Why should we expect spirits to do that? It took them a minute. It was a good, we got a couple EVPs before we even began, but the intelligent responses started coming through after we had been there for a while, and I think the spirits got comfortable with us. When I asked the spirit in the schoolhouse area to knock on the wall and you get a clear yes, you know, and that, although they didn't knock on the wall, but they said they could, which happens a lot, weirdly, where we'll ask them to do something, they'll say they can, but they don't actually do it. That happens a lot. I think it takes, my guess on that is that it takes less energy to say yes than it does to actually knock on the wall hard enough to make a noise, in terms of the amount of energy that's needed, depending on the kind of manifestation that you get. But I think the most interesting part of that investigation is the whole math thing. Check the video out if you haven't seen it, but in the school, this was a schoolhouse way back, and they have a room set up to, you know, with a desk and with the pictures of the schoolhouse and some artifacts and stuff like that. And Emily's just talking about lessons and talking about subjects. She's a teacher. So we thought, hey, put her in there. That's perfect. You know, school is in session at the Gilboa Museum for the first time in many years. And she's talking about different topics. And when she starts to talk about math, the K2 meter, the electromagnetic energy detector, that when it senses electromagnetic energy, it will spike, it will light up, it will indicate, and the more it lights up, the stronger the energy is. It wasn't doing it the entire night leading up to this. It had been sitting there for 2 hours before it did anything. And she says, you know, what about math? And it lights up. And then she says, she calls to me, she goes, Dan, I think whatever it is likes math. It flashes again. And then we get an EVP, a voice, a whisper saying, I like math. The dictionary definition of an intelligent response. And that's pretty exciting. That's a really, really cool coming together of different types of evidence, where you have the K2 spiking and then you have an EVP, an electronic voice phenomenon, that our equipment picks up. We can't hear it, but the equipment hears it. And so later on, when we're looking to review it, we're like, oh, I that was one where I was like, whoa, wow, that one was pretty cool. And that one's definitely going to be one that of my favorites. That'll be one we highlight at the end of the year, probably, as one of our favorites. I hope we catch a lot that are just as good as that the rest of the year, but that one's a great one. And I made the comment that I've never once been scared, really, while doing this, and that's true. But now that we've run into a spirit that likes math, I'm terrified. Because, wow, I mean, being a spirit's not scary. Loving math, that to me, scary. I was a terrible math student. My father was a math teacher, so that went over real well in my house. But that investigation, now, I don't know if the weather had anything to do with the activity being higher than I sort of anticipated for a first investigation, because there were some nasty, nasty storms coming through the area, so much so that we actually started the investigation early. So that we could, because we didn't want the weather to just rain us out. Paranormal equipment, especially the audio, is extremely, extremely sensitive. And, like, if you're outside and it's raining, you'll hear each individual raindrop hit a recorder. So thunder and lightning and hard rain can ruin an investigation. We did an investigation of Hyde Hall that got completely ruined. And we've never actually published any of it because there was nothing really to publish. It just destroyed that investigation. So, but a giant storm was moving in. And when storms move in, thunder, lightning, a lot of electromagnetic energy in the air, and that can, in theory, spark paranormal activity. Was that why we got so much, you know, good evidence and good activity? I have no idea, because I've never investigated that location when a storm wasn't moving in. So I don't have a control group as to what the normal amount that you get. And actually, with paranormal investigations, there is no control group. That's why paranormal studies don't hold up well against scientific method, because there is no real control group. But that's another episode. I talked about that, I believe, in the second episode of the podcast, the definition debacle. Check that one out. That's an interesting conversation based on some books I read. So, great location. We enjoyed it. The video, everybody, museum's happy with it. Everybody who's seen it, I'll put a link in the description. Great investigation. Closing the book on that one for now. I can very much see us going back there, and the people who run it are fantastic. So there's no reason to think that we won't try that one again. Maybe next year. We're pretty booked for the rest of this year, thankfully. So. And we're continuing our review process, where I'm about halfway through looking at the stuff from the Omen Theater. I love investigating theaters. I say it all the time. And that video should come out in the next couple of weeks as well, just in time for us to go up to the Seneca Falls Historical Society, which we're investigating at the end of June. So lots of stuff coming up, very busy on the calendar, and very exciting for us. And as always, we're here to take you all along on the journey with us. We share everything, and we like to share our journey, hence the podcast, hence all of the social media, and hence all of the evidence that we publish. But at the end of the day, the more investigations you do, the more mistakes you make. And we've made many. But we rarely make the same mistake twice. And I take a lot of pride in that, and so does Emily. I mean, you live, you learn, you evolve. It's all part of the process. You can either admit your mistake and learn from it, or try to convince yourself it wasn't an error and then doom history to repeat itself. Mistakes are a part of life, and they are perfectly normal. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on the Paranormal Podcast.